This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A bar called Harold's Cave Creek Corral in Cave Creek, Arizona, about 600 miles from Salida, Colorado. The bar manager, a guy named Charlie Lutz, knows a regular named Bruce. Beer guy, Miller Lite, Coors Light, nothing fancy. Been coming in since around the pandemic. Approaches women, gets approached by women. Friendly, normal. On June 13th of 2025, Bruce is sitting at Harold's drinking a beer. 1 week later, Bruce doesn't come back. Well, because Bruce doesn't exist. His name is Barry Morphew. And on June 20th, 2025, he's pulled over in a traffic stop in Goodyear, Arizona, and arrested for the first-degree murder of his wife, Suzanne. Charlie Lutz found out that night, told Fox News Digital he spent 2 hours reading articles about the man he'd been serving drinks to for years. Had no idea. But somebody knew. Woman named Libby Spurl was at Harold's in March of 24 when the man she knew as Bruce walked up and asked her to dance. She looked right at him and said it to his face. "You're Barry Morphew." He told her no. She had the wrong person. And somebody else walked over and introduced him as Lee from Indiana. You know, Lee. Not Bruce, not Barry. Lee. A different name. From a different person at the same bar in the same town. That woman recognized Barry Morphew 6 months after investigators found Suzanne Morphew's remains in a shallow grave near Moffat, Colorado, and more than a year before prosecutors would allege Barry signed paperwork that nearly destroyed his single most important piece of physical evidence in Suzanne's murder case. Paperwork that law enforcement stopped with less than 24 hours to spare. Barry Morphew has now been charged with the same murder twice. The first time, the prosecution collapsed so badly that the lead prosecutor lost their law license. What Barry did between the first case dying and the second one coming to life, that behavioral record is what 12 jurors in Alamosa will carry into the deliberation room. Your thoughts as we go through this in the comments section. Suzanne Morphew vanished Mother's Day of 2020 from the couple's home near Salida, Colorado. Barry was charged with her murder in May of 2021. The prosecution had fell apart, repeated discovery violations, withheld evidence. The judge barred key witnesses. Charges were dismissed without prejudice in April of 2022 because they had bungled it so bad. The lead prosecutor, Linda Stanley, was disbarred by the Colorado Supreme Court in 2024 for said misconduct, allegedly. After the dismissal, Barry skipped town, left Colorado. Do you blame him? I mean, whether he did it or not, do you blame him? Especially if he didn't do it, I'd be getting out of Dodge too. This is not about the forensics, not about the legal strategy or whether the lab work holds up under cross-examination. This is about what Barry Morphew did when nobody was watching and what every single one of those choices means depending on which version of Barry Morphew is real. After the charges dropped, Barry didn't stay in Salida, didn't stay in Colorado. He moved more than 600 miles to Cave Creek, Arizona. Property tax records show he settled into the Stardust Trailer Park. Doesn't that sound lovely? Listed himself as self-employed. He'd been a landscaper, an independent contractor back in Colorado. According to reporting, he held no professional license in Arizona. Here's a version of this that makes complete sense for a wrongly accused man. There really is. His name is on national news. Linda Stanley's prosecution made him the most recognizable face in Colorado for a time before a jury ever heard a word. Every Google search returns murder suspect. He can't work, can't date, can't walk into a gas station without wondering if someone is staring. He went somewhere. Nobody knew him because staying meant living in prison without bars. That reading is not unreasonable. People have done exactly this, fled from false accusations, changed cities, started over because the court of public opinion convicted them before the court of law even got a chance. The other reading is simpler. He ran. The charges were dismissed without prejudice, which means they could come back at any time. A man who knows what investigators might eventually find in a shallow grave in the San Luis Valley has a reason to put distance between himself and Colorado. Neither reading is provable from the move alone. The question is what he did once he got there. He used at least two aliases: Bruce at the bar, Lee at the gas station, Lee Moore. In the grand jury indictment itself, a former Colorado deputy DA called running two aliases in the same small town uncommon. Barry, he said, clearly did not want to be known by Barry. The generous explanation still works here. Of course, he used fake names. Barry Morphew is a death sentence to any social setting. The moment someone Googles that name, the conversation is over. Using a different name isn't consciousness of guilt. It's the only way to have a human interaction without being tried in someone's living room before the appetizer arrives, basically. But one alias is protection. Two aliases is a system. Bruce at the bar, Lee at the gas station. Different names for different people in the same town. Nobody can cross-reference. Nobody walks into Harold's and says, hey, that guy you called Bruce, a gas station, knows him as Lee. That's not hiding from judgment. That's managing information. Barry was a regular at Harold's, according to the bar manager. Drank beer, approached women, was approached by women. Lutz described him as friendly, social, regular. Came in for years without raising a single red flag. When Libby Spurl recognized him in March of 24 and said his real name to his face, he denied it. Then someone walked over and introduced him as Lee from Indiana. Suzanne's remains had been found 6 months earlier. An autopsy would confirm homicide, and Barry is at a bar 600 miles away under a name that isn't his, asking a woman to dance. The generous reading? A wrongly accused man went to a bar and tried to have a normal life. He talked to people. He had a beer. When someone recognized him, he didn't want the nightmare to follow him into the one place where he could be a person instead of a headline. That's not sinister, that's survival. The other reading lives in the gap. What was being discovered about Suzanne's death and what Barry was doing with his evenings don't occupy the same universe. Either he genuinely believes he has nothing to worry about, or he's performing the life of someone who doesn't. Because while Barry is living at Stardust and going by Bruce at Harold's, the parallel reality is unfolding 600 miles east. In September of 23, investigators found human remains in a shallow grave near Moffat in the San Luis Valley. The remains are identified as Suzanne within days. A forensic anthropologist concludes she decomposed somewhere other than where she was found. No insect activity, no animal predation. Some of her foot bones are missing along with her bicycle shoes. Her cancer port and bike clothing are found with the remains. According to investigators, the body was moved at least twice. The El Paso County coroner ruled it a homicide. An autopsy identified bruparafol, azapurine, and metromedine, all three chemicals that make up a wildlife tranquilizer that we're going to call going forward BAM. It's known as BAM in Suzanne's bone marrow. Prosecutors allege that when Suzanne disappeared, only one private citizen in that entire area of Colorado had a prescription for BAM. Guess who it was? Barry Morphew. He'd admitted in interviews to using it on deer at the family home roughly a month before Suzanne vanished. Investigators had already found a tranquilizer rifle in a locked gun safe in the Morphew residence and a needle cap for one of the darts in the family's dryer. A grand jury is convened in the 12th Judicial District. It hears evidence over months. On June 18th of 25, it returns an indictment. First-degree murder. 2 days later, Barry's pulled over in Goodyear, Arizona. That routine traffic stop by the Arizona Department of Public Safety, taken into custody and extradited back to Colorado. And according to reporting, Barry was at Harold's on June 13th, 1 week before his arrest. The bar manager didn't learn Bruce's real name until the news broke that night. Barry smiled during his first court appearances after he was rearrested. Jail staff at the Alamosa County Detention Center, where he spent 3 months before posting bond, reportedly described him as a superb inmate who kept to himself and showed respect for staff. According to his attorney, he was liquidating all of his assets to cover legal bills. Supporters helped post part of his $3 million bond. His daughters, Macy and Mallory, appeared with him at the January 26th arraignment in Alamosa. He pled not guilty for the second time. The generous reading. He smiled because he knows the truth, and he knows what a jury will eventually see. He was a model inmate because he's a decent person and in an innocent situation. He's selling everything he owns because the system is bleeding him dry for a crime he didn't commit. His daughters stand with him because they know their father. The other reading. He smiled because he peed it once and believes he can do it again. He was a model inmate because controlling perception is what he does. Look at Charlie Lutz, who thought he was Bruce for years. His daughters stand with him because they've been standing with him since the beginning. Whether that's the purest expression of a family's faith or the longest con in the case depends entirely on which version of Barry you believe. And that leads to the fracture nobody can really explain. Suzanne's own daughters walk into court besides Barry. Suzanne's sister, Melinda Balazar, and her brother, David Mormon, stand against him. Her brother has publicly called Barry soulless and said there's no redemption for him. A murdered woman's children standing with the man accused of killing their mother against the dead woman's own siblings. Both sides cannot be right. One of them has to be in the wrong. January 29th to 26th, 2 weeks after pleading not guilty, Barry signed paperwork authorizing the release of Suzanne's remains from the El Paso County Coroner's Office to a funeral home. Prosecutors learned the remains had been released on February 17th. They scramble for a search warrant. A judge signs it February 18th. And February 19th, the undersheriff goes to the funeral home to collect the remains. That's when he discovers Suzanne's body is scheduled for cremation the following day. One day. If that undersheriff had arrived 24 hours later, the remains that contained BAM, the prosecution's central forensic evidence, would have been ash. A second search warrant on February 24th turns up two forms with Barry's signature. One of them authorized the cremation. Prosecutors laid it out directly in their filing. The defendant in a murder case authorized the release of the murder victim's remains prior to pending motions and jury trial. He paid to have them cremated before his own experts' opinions were disclosed or court rulings on admissibility of scientific testing were issued. That's the take. Barry's defense filed a motion saying he takes no position on the matter. The generous reading exists here, but it has to work harder than anywhere else in this story. The daughters wanted their mother's remains released. They filed a motion for it. Barry signed the paperwork as next of kin. Maybe it was about burial, about faith, about closure. Maybe the cremation was the funeral home's recommendation and Barry didn't think about the evidentiary implications. Maybe takes no position is exactly what an innocent man's lawyer tells him to say when the optics are terrible. But the intent was clean. Of course, the other reading is there too. The one man in America who would benefit most from the bones being destroyed signed the paperwork to destroy them. And if one undersheriff had gotten there one day later, the BAM in Susan's femur, the evidence prosecutors say ties Barry to the no one else in her death, would be gone. The aliases in Arizona have a generous explanation. The bar life has a generous explanation. The smile in court has a generous explanation. The cremation paperwork is the moment where the generous explanation has to do the most heavy lifting. Whether it holds up to 12 people in Alamosa, time will tell. Barry's been charged with the same murder twice. The first prosecution was so flawed, the prosecutor lost her law license. The second is built on bones, chemistry, and a wildlife tranquilizer that allegedly only one private citizen in that part of Colorado had access to. Between those two prosecutions, Barry Morphew moved 600 miles. He used at least two names that weren't his. He denied his own identity to a stranger he recognized that recognized him. He drank beer at a bar under aliases while investigators were pulling wildlife tranquilizer from his wife's femur bone. He smiled in court after being arrested a second time, and he allegedly signed paperwork to cremate the remains that contained the prosecution's most damning evidence one day before law enforcement intervened. Jury selection is scheduled for October 13th, 2026 in Alamosa. 12 people will sit across from Barry Morphew and try to answer the same question that lives underneath every moment in this behavioral record. Not whether the science hold, not whether Bam was really in Suzanne's bones, not whether the chain of custody is clean or the lab was properly certified. Those are questions the lawyers will fight over for 6 weeks. The question underneath, when it follows Barry Morphew from the Stardust Trailer Park to Harold's Cave Creek Corral to the Alamosa County Courthouse, doesn't require a chemistry degree. It just requires looking at everything he did and asking honestly, does this make sense? What do you think? Tell me in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us or watching us on YouTube. Hit subscribe. And if you want to take us on the road with you in audio form, pick us up on your favorite podcast player. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe. We do greatly appreciate that. Again, we'll continue the conversation in the comments section. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.